another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my very special guest, Timothy Sofer, former member of the NAR. Tiffany, it's good to be together and finally recording. We've tried a few times and scheduling, it just hasn't worked out. But today we're finally getting to connect and talk about the NAR, and you've got quite a story to tell, the many different groups and aspects that we're going to be talking through. So thank you so much for joining us. Maybe you could tell a little bit about yourself.
So I live now in Southern Oregon in a little town of about 200 people, and lived here for about 3 years. I've lived all over the United States. I am originally Canadian, born in Canada, and I moved to Mexico when I was 16, and just really excited to share my story today. So
Oregon is a hot spot in the research. I don't know that I've published everything yet, but from Oregon, it seems, because if you connect it to Christian identity, there were some really connected people that were flowing from Oregon, and the trails seem to converge there, and I haven't yet figured why, but they do converge. Maybe you can help us learn more.
Yeah, well, so I'll start off with Canada, because that's where I was born. So I was born in Vancouver, BC, and I was actually adopted as an older child, is, you know, what they would call it. I was almost 5 years old. And the family that I was adopted into had one of the longest running private adoption agencies in BC, and they actually helped them write the curriculum for the government for adoption at one point. And when the government or the province of BC couldn't find a place for me and my older brother and my younger sibling to be adopted to, they contacted this private agency and made the connection. And then the people that owned that agency asked their own, you know, daughter if they know anyone who'd want to be adopted. And she said we would. And so we were adopted into that family. And, you know, trying to parcel out like what I say and what I don't say. We know a lot more now about how to support children that have been through foster care and that have been adopted in today's day and age. But back then, there were certain principles about taking care of traumatized kids who that didn't exist as much back then. Things happened within the family. They really came out when I was about 10 years old. And things kind of hit the fan. And after they did, there was this, to my eyes as a young girl, this big switch between how our family operated. My parents started going to these, I think they called them conferences at that point. They started going to these conferences. And they started, now looking back on it, I would consider it maybe grooming, I don't know. But they started having these kind of life lessons for the children and about, you know, calling us for breakfast. There were six of us at this point. And they would have dog food in a cereal bowl and pour milk on it and start eating it. And all the kids are like, ew, that's gross. What are you doing? And they would say, well, yeah, this is kind of like life. There's like the regular life that you see that everyone's doing. And then there's something better, something more glorious. And then they would, another time, you know, for dinner, we'd come for dinner and all the plates, there's nothing on it. And the woman adopted me would like sprinkle cake sprinkles or cupcake sprinkles on the plates. And we're like, that's not dinner. That's not going to fill us up. That's not enough. And they're like, you're right. There's something better. And so I never connected those actions happening right before they actually started taking us kids to the conferences. And so basically we got introduced to Joel's Army back up in Abbotsford, BC, when Todd Bentley wasn't as well known as he was before the Charismatic Day of Infamy in 2008. So this was back in 2001, I think, was one of the first conferences that we went to. And I was all for it. I fell for it hard. I was about 12 years old the first time that I went. By this time, my older brother was no longer living with the family. And my younger siblings were younger, and I don't know how much they understood about what was being taught. But one of the, you know, consequences of just some of the generational things in my birth family is that I'm actually autistic, and I can struggle with language sometimes. And so when I'd be at these conferences and hearing all this language about, you know, teaching us different things, I'm going, well, what do you mean? Like, try to get to the real tangible portions of it, you know, because it just seemed really grandiose and really like lots of filler stuff, that kind of spiritual speak. And I was like trying to picture what they were actually trying to say. And I have finally got to a point a couple years ago where I could summarize it. And it would be that we were being taught that our highest calling in life was to go through a deification process to become immortal and then use our supernatural powers to, in my instance of what I was being taught, kill people.
Wow.
What you guys talk about, like the sacred purge.
It's so widespread. A lot of people don't realize just how many people believe and think this way in these movements. The Joel's Army doctrine spread all throughout Christian identity and then kind of went underground in the 60s. But you'll find these ministers out in remote areas that are teaching it. What's interesting is the autism, it's kind of like a gift and a curse. I had another lady, I don't know if she mentioned that she had it on the podcast, but I had another lady that also had autism. And exactly like you said, the brain is wired in such a way that it wants to get all the information to process it. But the way that these cults work, they purposefully withhold information so you can't process it. So in this weird way, having the autism actually is to your benefit when you're in a cult.
And I didn't speak much until I was a little older. And so when they presented all these different supernatural gifts that you could develop as part of being in this army for God, the prophecy didn't appeal to me because I wasn't comfortable with just like coming up with words and putting things together because it wasn't accurate enough. And other things didn't, but it was, and this was something that Todd Bentley had said, and it's a quote that I had carried for me with like a long time. And this is why I wonder how much of his teachings have changed, is he said that with this, you know, supernatural power, people like me would be able to, quote, vaporize their enemies in a mist of blood.
Wow.
And so I held on to that, as by this time I was like 15 years old, and I'm like wanting to be super hardcore, you know, to please my adoptive family, because my brother actually had to leave. He ended up spending a couple of years in juvenile detention and then went back into the foster care system. And I was scared that if I didn't like toe the line, that the same thing would happen to me. So to me, I think it was like, that was the most hardcore thing that you could do in being part of this army. And so I'm like, I'm going to go for it. Like, that's going to be my gift that I, you know, practice, because you have to practice these gifts to get stronger and stronger in them. And as you get stronger in them, you get more purified, and then you reach your, you know, at some point, you know, getting your immortal body and stuff, right? So so we went to these conferences. That was what I internalized as what my highest calling was going to be. And through these conferences, my adoptive parents actually felt like they were supposed to pack everything up. My dad quit his job. And the eight of us moved down to this place in Mexico. And I'm really trying not to give all the details about this, but this place, about how we got there, but this place in Mexico, I don't know, do you know much about the fundamentalist, the FLDS, the Colonia Liberan in Mexico? Have you heard much about the Mexican Manson? And
I've heard some, but not a lot. Maybe you could tell us.
So when you think of like Mormonism and polygamy being outlawed in the United States, and so there were different sects that left to go, some went to Canada, some went down to Mexico. There are families that went down to Mexico, and they had this blood atonement doctrine where not all sins could be given, be forgiven without having your own blood as being atonement for the sins. And so there is the Mexican manse and a guy named Erval LeBaron essentially wanted to take over his older brother's church that he inherited. And so there were these mass killings that happened and just terrible, terrible stuff. Anyways, the older brother left the colony in Chihuahua, Mexico, to go to Baja, the Baja Peninsula, right below Tijuana, right below San Diego. And there was a mass murder that happened there in the 70s. And then so the cult splinter that was down there. And then the group that my parents joined is the group that took over the homes of the Mormon community in this community called Zarambla, which means like paradise or seeds of compassion. And so there's this intermixing between the two different groups that happened. And there's fallout to this day from not just that intermixing, but because there was marriages between the two groups. So we come down to, and there was this prophecy that was, you know, foretold about the Christians renting the homes from the Mormons or something. I've heard so many different things about it, right? But so we moved down to this group in Mexico, and that's where I meet my husband. I was 16, he was 15, and you know, one of the things that you do when you're in a cult is you get married really young. So he was 17 and I was 18 when we got married. We are both the oldest sibling, or the second oldest siblings of six. Both of the older brothers that were 3 dates apart left the family for various, you know, reasons. With his family, his older brother is actually kicked out of the cult as a young teen, which has its own set of consequences. But the movement in Mexico is this convergence between the Jesus people, IHOP, and Seventh-day Adventist. And at this point, you know, my husband and I spent a year down there in Mexico before we left to go to the United States. And I was still, you know, it wasn't as militarized and it wasn't as much about the spiritual warfare as it was up in Canada. But my parents tried to bring that down into the group in Mexico and was essentially teaching Joel's army that I know of to the children that were in Mexico. And so they started accumulating even more and more children. And at one point, I believe there was up to like 33 people in just in one house that were caretakers or the children or family.
It's so hard to believe because this is a very militant doctrine and we're talking physically violent that they're teaching the kids in these other countries. And you have to think about the way in which the culture is spreading. So as it goes into Mexico, everyone who's around this, they view this as what we're calling Christianity from America. And so it's hard, it's really hard not to think about some of the other groups that become militant against the Christians because they're seeing this go out. Well, this is a very militant thing. So this must be American Christianity. So we must rise against it and fight it. So it's actually doing so much more harm than it is good.
And it's really interesting, too, because the spiritual warfare components were brought down, but the, you know, sacred purge components of them weren't quite as focused on. Those were kind of skirted around a little bit as far as, like, they would still use some of the language, but it's the, you know, when you think things out to their logical conclusion, right? Like nobody thought out that far. But I already come to that conclusion because of listening and gathering all the information about what they're actually saying. If you were to take it, and yeah, it's in very spiritual terms, but you take it to apply it today. Like when they're talking about physically healing people, you know, like using spiritual means to physically heal people, using spiritual means to raise people from the dead. And then, so then it's like using spiritual means to destroy people, right? And to destroy the enemy. But wow. Like when you're not thinking through it, right? So it's really interesting because this group down in Mexico, there would be jokes about how they're a bunch of misfits. And as I think about it in the last couple of years, it's basically this group of people who left the United States because of, I mean, sometimes it was because of scandal, you know, we had one, you know, pastor who was in charge of an orphanage and he ended up, you know, he was abusive and he ended up stealing ministry funds to go on a drinking binge in the States. And, you know, he blackmails his own children. You've got another person who was one of the leaders and he ended up, you know, abusing someone that was under his care. They call it an affair, but we know it's more to that because this person was under their care. And like, so there were several splits in this movement and leadership change. It's all based off of scandal from all this abuse and stuff. And so I'm at the point with my family. I have a brother that is dead. I have another brother that's in prison. I have a sister that's been institutionalized. I have, like, there's all of this fallout from it. And I'm being trying to, like, raise the alarm. Like, you guys, this is not the fruit that's supposed to happen from what you guys are say that you're teaching. You know, there's these mixed messages and it's, so I'm at the point where, I have family members that don't talk to me, you know, we've had death threats in our family, you know? And it's like, do you guys see the red warnings? Yeah. Do you see any of this? But it's just this wall. It's this wall. And people are continuously getting hurt. So
from the outside looking in, see, they don't really make public all of the things that you're talking about when you're in these groups. All you see is the bright, shiny, happy people. And you see, you know, come worship us. We're happy. We're a community. But you don't see what's running underneath it. And it's really, really problematic. Half of the things that I have found on the website with Branhamism had no idea existed until after I left and I started digging. Once you, you know, peel the rock up, you can watch all the spiders flee, right? And I have a feeling that the more groups that we examine that descended from Branhamism, you're going to see the same thing because they had the same parent. So as you're talking through some of these sayings, I'm now going back through my head through some of the different areas that I came in contact with, wondering, well, I wonder if they taught the Joel's Army, and I wonder if they were militarized in the same way.
Yeah, and like even, and it's interesting because I'm trying to figure out still, like, there's so much to the story that, like when we think about Michael Flynn going to, I don't know if you know about the conference that he went to in California where he was gifted an AR-15, right? And he made the joke about, you know, finding somebody in Washington, you know, yeah. And everybody that was there at the conference laughed. Did you hear that or?
No, but I knew that he was attending some, and I've actually watched some other NAR conferences where they've got AKs and different weird things in the meetings.
Yeah. So that church, that particular one that I saw, you know, was at the leaders of that church are personal friends with my in-laws. So in like when I pieced together, because for the longest time, I thought I was like making it up. I thought I was twisting what I had been taught, especially when it comes to like the, you know, the sacred purge part of it. Like, no, Tiff, you're twisting it, you're reading into things, like that's not at all what they said. Cause I would go back to my parents and be like, this is the concept, right? Like, this is what we're supposed to be doing, right? Cause I ask a lot of questions. I need a lot of clarity. And I think that in itself actually is one of the things that led to the loss of engagement that certain people in my family now have with my life, you know, of just not checking in with me as a person and or my family and stuff, is asking those questions and kind of mirroring back what is being taught and kind of like, I would imagine, the ugliness of it. But I thought that maybe it was me just making up this, twisting this doctrine or something. So then when I finally got the courage to look it up, that's when I came across John Robert Stevens and this, in this concept of like throwing curses so that you can kind of kill someone on the spot, right? You know, for God. And I think about Jim Jones, you know, throwing a curse, you know, at William Branham, or the pastor of this church, you know, where Michael Flynn was, you know, given the AR-15, talking about how he thinks he's the one that killed Anton LaVey. And that's a wild story in and of itself, you know, and this person is like the spiritual warfare instructor for YWAM. And so, so seeing all of these, listening through the episodes and seeing all of these different convergences of the different movements and how somehow it meets all in Mexico and then it goes out from Mexico. My sister and my brother were part of IHOP for a couple of years until they just left and are coming out of that. And but when I finally found out and then I came to your material through researching, you know, am I crazy? Did I really think that this is what they were teaching us? And then coming through it, I'm not. And then the fallout from it is logical.
It is disturbing. And I don't think people really grasp how disturbing it is until you're in it and you see it. I was completely shocked whenever I started reading through Michael Barkun's book, Religion and the Racist Right. He had not fully tied it to Latter Rain in the same way. He did mention William Branham a couple times and in the Serpent Seed Doctrine, but he hadn't really made all of the links because I don't think he knew at the time he wrote that, that Gordon Lindsay, who is the founder of CEFNI, Christ for the Nations, who was also William Branham's, you know, campaign manager, I don't think he realized that he was a key figure in identity conferences. But he's going through all identity and watching the development of it in the United States, and they're teaching this radicalized Joel's Army doctrine because it is tied to what they're calling, what they believe to be an end of days race war. So if you're of that mindset, you believe that the enemy forces are coming to invade the United States, we as Christians have to defend it because I don't know why, but the United States is the one place on the earth that Christians will defend. And so all of these people are coming and we need to militarize ourselves. That was what they believed. And Barkun really explains that well in his book. What he didn't know, like I said, is he didn't tie it to Latter Rain, because if you, once you make that leap and you realize that the foundation of it was the Latter Rain movement, well, from Latter Rain came the Charismatic movement all the way up to the New Apostolic Reformation. So all of these ties come from the same foundation.
It's amazing. I mean, and part of it is, as I do, you know, my own research and tracing back the movements, even like in Canada. So I think it's been like 10 years now that I've been researching the NIR. And I started asking questions to my grandfather. And this is where I can kind of relate to your story about asking your grandfather questions. I start asking questions. And when I was a little girl, I'm super curious, very like, what's the word? Why is it escaping me right now? Existential, you know, even as a young girl. And so having these really in-depth conversations, but then after my time in Mexico coming up and being like, what's this? And what does that mean? And have you ever heard of the New Apostolic Reformation and stuff? And the answers started becoming smaller and smaller to the point where it's like, I don't know. And then it's to the point where, you know, when I come up and visit in Canada, you know, he just hides in his room and watches hockey, and we don't have any of our conversations anymore. It wasn't until researching about the connection with the full gospel and the New Lateran, and that's how he was raised, when I would go to him with these flags, you know, like, you know, it should be a screaming red flag when a father calls up somebody and says, hey, God told me he's going to kill you. You know, it's like, you know, hello, like, wake up. That's not normal. That's a really big red flag. But I can imagine, like, all the different dynamics that go into, you know, those questions of, are people malicious or are they deceived? And I would say in my case, it's just a lot of deception. Even seeing how close my own ties are to North Battlefield, Saskatchewan, and we have, you know, when we're talking about some of the current NAR leaders or those that have fallen out being William Branham 2.0, there's now a Todd Bentley 2.0 up in British Columbia right now, leading revivals back to North Battleford, you know, where it all began. And when these groups are talking about buying land and everyone living together, and as I'm researching the history, I'm like, no, don't do that. You know, like, there's like that, you know, instinct reaction I have to it. I don't even know what else to say about it. But when I've heard people talk about Todd Bentley, sometimes the focus is on the outcomes of his, like, personal life and how it affects his ministry and people in it, but not always talking so much about the theology, especially when it comes to, you know, and I think that's just kind of a phenomenon when people hear about cults, is they think about the outcomes of the cults and not the dynamics of the cults. And so I'm really interested in the dynamics, because you can see them being repeated across. It's just the same patterns across this, you know, whether it's a small group within like a family, whether it's in a church, whether it's in a movement, whether it's in a, and it just kind of keeps growing.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Lateran, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. One of the reasons that I've been so fascinated studying John Wimber, as I'm studying the transition from what was Lateran into Charismatics into New Apostolic Reformation, Wimber made popular the notion that you want he called it the feels, the experience. It was experience over doctrine. And so you had to get this experience. And they really amplified what an original, in the, you know, modern Pentecostalism, when it was rebirthed, they had to some extent the same thing as you would experience what they called the baptism of the Holy Ghost. Once you started speaking in tongues, they said you had the experience, the Pentecostal experience. But Wimber amplified it so much further that a lot of times the doctrines were just completely overlooked. And in doing so, it seems that it made it easier for those who had these beliefs, the Stroh's Army, Christian identity stuff, to kind of slip under the radar, because they weren't really preaching so much doctrine as they were just the emotions. They wanted to get people to come, have an emotional experience. And then that was the hook. Once they hooked you and you get into some of these smaller churches, especially in the remote areas, now they're teaching the same things that was, you know, woven through the Lateran movement, etc. So it kind of, it made it in such a way that these people could really just slip under the radar unnoticed.
So I'm curious, like, what do you know about when you talk about, you know, Todd Bentley being William Branham, you know, 2.0, what about him was it that makes you say that? I'm curious. Because I know, like, there's the manifested sons of God, you know, doctrine, but is there other things as well that...
Yeah, more specifically, it was the IHOP KC and the Kansas City Fellowship were attempting to create a Branhamism 2.0. Basically, what they wanted to do, they wanted to emulate the revival that happened in the 50s. And so they started bringing in many of the same doctrines. Bentley was a part of it and a component because he was... I think it was Bob Jones that initiated it, but Bentley started popularizing the idea that the same angel that Branham had was coming to our revival through IHOP KC in this movement. And he was saying, they called it Emma, the angel Emma. And so the angel Emma has come down, and what they were essentially telling the people is that the same thing that we had during Branhamism, now we're having it again because it's the same exact angel that's coming down. And even though some of the doctrines are quite different, the foundation was much the same, and it was all, the Joel's Army theology was woven all through it. So it had the same foundation, even though from the surface it probably looked a lot different.
So, yeah, and I'm still trying to figure out, like, living in that space between wanting to raise the alarm, you know, because apparently the trail of destruction is not being noticed. I think like one of the common themes that I've seen within, you know, the, especially the children of the leaders of what essentially there was, you know, the original, you know, group, the group that my family moved down to. And then that group actually splintered up after there were some, you know, horrible things that happened, which created this void. And then leaders from California came down and didn't necessarily fill that void, but started their own thing alongside the destruction of the first group. And that group even was more destructive than the first. So there would be times I'd go down to Mexico and I quite literally couldn't see my own family because they were in their meetings, or it was one of those days where they were on communication shutdown. And it got to a point, there was a story from my, the woman that adopted me, where, and this is the concept of the spiritual, you know, fathers and spiritual children, where the cult leader who was a breeder of fighting dogs in the States and actually spent time in prison for it and counterfeit money and stuff, this guy asked my mom, or asked my dad, to give my mom over to him in spiritual authority. You know, wow. Like, and they were holding, like, he had his second in command go to technically to go kidnap one of the kids, you know, to try to use as pressure against my parents. Although that's not the wording that they would use, but that's essentially what it was. He sent his, you know, second in command to go get this child. And then the guy was like, no, this is a bad idea. So he didn't do it, but he was on his way to do it. And then it comes to find out that this second guy, like, he was a former sicario, which is used for, like, a cartel hitman. And so, like, you don't have, again, it's this pattern of lack of accountability. Nobody's checking anybody for their, you know, their backgrounds and whether or not, because all of this kind of situation is around trying to be all these foster homes and all these kids. And so these kids are now, we've had a couple that have committed suicide. We've had, again, with the intersection between the Mormon cult and the Christians, the Mormon cult made their money and attracted the Mexican cartel to the point where even just recently there was that big massacre, you know, in 2019, you know, and there was other murders in 2009. But the Mormon cult was making so much money going across into the States and bringing money down and building all these big houses. And the cartel is like, what are you doing? And there's other, you know, connections with that colonial baron and other, you know, drug trafficking and things like that. But because of the cross section between the two cults, I have siblings that got wrapped up into some of the businesses that happened. And then there was, you know, things that happened in the States too. So like, it's just this, I have a new sense of what the generational curses mean. Cause I used to think the curses were in, you know, the power of the tongue, you know, is, you know, that you could throw a curse and you could kill somebody, or you could bless somebody and heal them. Right. And so that's my kind of voodoo magic, witchcraft type spiritualism, you know, that I thought generational curses were. But now I see more the dynamics of how the way that you grow up affects your decisions and how you're not able to cope with the real world when you go out into the real world. And so my husband and I now do quite a bit to help my siblings as they leave and they're in culture shock that the world isn't as bad as, you know, on one hand, as everybody told them it was, and how to be adults, how to, you know, save up money and to cope with certain things. But, and so, what's interesting to me though, is the connection between the unhealth, obviously, of the groups and the amount of sickness, not just mental, but physical sickness. And it's just kind of this spiral that goes downhill. So, yeah. And we see that everywhere. Yeah.
I'm glad you brought that up because that's a subject I think doesn't get really talked about that much. When you're raised in this type of environment, I just had the conversation earlier today with somebody. The people, how did the person say it? So the people have such a negative outlook on life. Everything's bad. There's nothing good. Everybody's out to get me. The world is dying, which if you're in Christianity, you're looking for the, you know, the second coming of Christ and you're looking for the biblical things to unfold. However, you're looking at the positive side. And in these movements, instead, you're looking at the negative side. And what that does to a person's psyche is horrific because now you're taking away all ambition. You're raising children to have no future outlook. And then sadly, because this has been going on for almost a century now. So as this Christian identity thing is training these kids and manipulating their heads, well, those people grew up to be adults. And now here are people with this negative outlook who can now vote, who can now be a danger to others because they have an array of problems. I'll just say it like that to keep it past the YouTube filters. These people really need more help than can be given. But how do you do that, right? It would be an ongoing therapy if somebody's, say, 50 years old and they've been indoctrinated to be that negative for 50 years. How long does it take in therapy to undo the negativity? So this is a huge, huge problem.
Yeah. And part of my story, I mean, like, I'm only up to age like 18 at this point, and I'm 37. And so I thought that when you think about the seven mountain mandates and being, you know, Christian leaders in the different, you know, mountains, and one of the things I really wanted to be when I grow up, from a young age is cardiothoracic surgery. And so when I was in college doing my undergraduate degree in biochemistry, I was incredibly sick. I was so sick. And I had actually been on a journey for about 5 years by then of there's something wrong with my body, but I don't know what it is. And I eventually led my doctors to discover that I had a really, really bad case of a particular autoimmune disease. And to the point where my doctors told me that I shouldn't be driving. They were concerned about me falling into a coma behind the wheel on the road. I was so sick. And my husband was doing the shopping and the cleaning and the chores and like everything, because all I could do was sleep and work. And then years later, like there's this steady pattern, and we're not even talking about like the mental fallout. You know, I've had three siblings that have been institutionalized on and off. At one point, the man that adopted me actually got active tuberculosis. And according to his profile, you know, being like a white man down in Mexico, he would be better off than the workers in the field. But why was he susceptible to his body not being able to contain the tuberculosis? So they actually did a whole bunch of tests. They thought maybe he had cancer, maybe they had like something else that was going on. But when we talk about like the nervous system and the chronic state of stress that you're in, and the way that it affects your body and makes you susceptible to different things, it's a real problem. And so I think about that phrase about escaping a cult, right? Like, I wonder, is like, can you really escape it though? Because there's so many different, there's so much fallout from it that I think, you know, I have a hard time believing anybody would be able to really wrap up all of the strands of damage that have come, you know, from it because of the consequences being just really so severe.
I look at it much like people who were in a prison concentration camp, some other country. You'll never be able to take away from them the experience of having been in that camp. And it, you know, in some cases, we have prisoners of war who come back and they have PTSD for the rest of their lives. They struggle with things, right? They can get help, but they struggle from many things. However, some of the people who are able to change the outlook use that as empowerment to help other people and do other tremendous things. So it's not like you can take it away, right? I can never take away the fact that I was in a cult. But what I can is change my outlook on life so that I can help others and they hopefully don't fall into the same problems.
I see how you've done that. And me coming across your material has been probably one of the most foundational turns in my outlook that I'm not alone. And I've been able to share it with other members of, you know, family or friends so that they can get context about, you know, what happened. And then I'm also on this journey too of like, you know, how do we help prevent stuff like this from happening? And so even in my work now, it's, you know, not sharing so much my story or sharing the research, that's more fun and on the side. But now I'm, you know, trying to converge. That's been like a theme, that word converging, right? Lately for me, so I say it a lot, is my experiences and researching the effects of, you know, childhood, adverse childhood effects and future health outcomes. I work in the healthcare, the intersection between rural dynamics, nonprofit, and the healthcare sector. I've been working on a rural access model for about 4 years now that has gotten lots of attention from the state of Oregon and even from CMS. And so it's like, how do we help to buffer, you know, in the future, this kind of course correction that really starts at a really young age? To get people the resources that they need. Because you see, when we talk about the different stories of people who come up to be some of these, the malicious leaders, because there are some, you know, or the people that become deceived, you look back into their stories about what would make them susceptible to certain things. And so we got to start there. And that's what I'm trying to do. So I figure we all have our different parts, and encouraging each other is definitely a big part of it.
Sounds like you're making some progress and helping other people. And hopefully others who are listening can do the same, because as this grows and spreads and people help other people, this can change the tide. And like the army of darkness that has been created by this thing, we have an army of light that is helping. So what advice would you give somebody who has been in this sort of thing and then suddenly they've lifted up the rock and they've seen all the spiders scatter and they see just the mess that was covered up? What advice would you give them when they first find out?
I have a couple of, I don't like using the word mantras because it just doesn't sound right to me, but I don't know what else you would call them. But I've had them up kind of my ways of encouraging myself that I think would be applicable to answering your question. And so it's, you know, something that I've gathered over the years. And so one is just affirming to ourselves that we aren't angels, you know, and we're not beasts, we're humans. And then two is study everything, but don't follow anyone, right? Three is to love hard, but to grieve well. And I think there's a lot of grief that comes from being in situations like these, and there's so much emotional turmoil that it's kind of this flip side of, you know, people, there's so much emotional control. There's so much pent up anger. There's so much pent up grief, but like continue to love, like don't let your heart crust over, like continue to love, but in that loving, you're still going to probably have lots of hurt and grieve it, you know, so you got to have the both, love hard, grieve well. And then my favorite one though, that I think is the most applicable is don't be afraid of the dark. And the reason why I say that is because there's such a focus on like the light and the darkness, and we're trying to combat the darkness. But I think sometimes when we're trying to combat darkness, we become like monsters ourselves in a way. Because we fear the dark and we fear the darkness. But to really unravel some of this stuff, you do really have to do some deep work. And that deep work can be very, you know, scary for some people, which is why it doesn't get done, right? But I think that if we can find even find God, you know, for one, but find that the stillness and that almost like a pilot light and grab hold onto the pilot light that's there to, and use it, you know, to comb through the dark, through the scary thoughts that you have about coming. What happens if I do this and I do that? And could be fallout from family members as you want to separate yourselves or as you're trying to heal. There's a lot of scariness in it, but don't be scared of it. You know, don't fear the fear, you know, tackle it head on, find that courage to start disseminating the stuff, because that's where the work is.
And I've talked to a few people now who were raised in the very militant version of this. There seems to be a lighter version, which they don't really talk about what you're going to do to other people. And there's this weird lighter version, but then there's this darker version where they really get deep with the Joel's Army rhetoric. And it is a literally army. It is an army mindset that they're training children with. So you're the first person who has spoken publicly about it. I've talked to a few people now. I'm curious to know from your perspective, how, after being raised in this, how do you overcome the negative thoughts towards other people, and how do you retrain your mind to love other people?
I mean, critical thought is definitely it. So I'm very somebody who does the thought experiments, like following things out to their conclusion. And I would pair that with this idea of like, don't be afraid of the dark, because I think sometimes, especially in the particular subject matter that we're talking about, like my job when I was young, and like there was so much shame that I had around it, an incredible amount of shame. And that's actually one of the reasons why I want to share my story, because I know that I'm not the only person who was told that this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to practice your witchcraft and killing people, you know, by, you know, I mean, you don't, might not have a little doll with voodoo, and I don't know much about voodoo, but my minimal concept of it is that you're putting curses on people. Like, you're not doing that, but I was, you know, gearing up and psyching myself because I was told that's what we have to do. And the consequences of that, when you think about that, is so scary, because I was thinking about this the other day, and I know this is a long answer to your question. I was thinking about this the other day of, like, I was constantly like, I got to practice my witchcraft of learning how to curse people so that they will die. And because I'm quite literal sometimes, and that phrase, you know, vaporize your enemy in a mist of blood, I thought that I would do my, you know, speaking in tongues and the person would explode. Like, that's literally what I thought it would be like. But I thought that there'd be this time that I would be alive and I would hear the shofar from the skies, you know, hear the blow of the trumpet from heaven, like some audible thing. And that's when I know that, all right, it's the time. Now the army's going to send out, and now you're actually going to go out in the streets and you're going to start, you know, anyone that comes against you, you're going to say your words and they're going to explode. Like, that's literally what I thought was going to happen. But I realize now it could possibly be even more sinister than that, because the reality I spoke of sounds very like a caricature, right? Like, it's, I had someone tell me it's, like Christian Dungeons and Dragons. And I really appreciated that comment, because it kind of really showed the absurdity of it. On the other hand, I think it would be more like all these prophets or false prophets of the NIR saying, I heard from God and he said, now is the time. And I think of all the paramilitaries and the militias that are being constructed right now in different areas, and the real nature of what could possibly happen, because you've had generations that have been essentially brainwashed into preparing for a war. And so on the one hand, that's kind of scary to think of. So when I think about how do you dig into that realm of, I was essentially preparing myself to potentially be like a domestic terrorist, is really what it is. And not being afraid of the dark, giving yourself the grace to think through some of these thought experiments and following things to their logical conclusion, so that you can identify and use some critical thinking about what is good and what is not. And then being able to thinking about like the fruits of the spirit, because we're used to some of the horrific fruits that are not of the spirit, but thinking of the fruits of the spirit and following things out through some very scary territory, thought-wise, to their conclusion, to discern what the outcome would be, to start breaking some of the some of that fear. Because once you do it the first time, it gets easier the second time, you know, as you start following through about what's, you know, right and what's not right, what's loving, what's not loving. It's hard work. But dealing with that shame, as you go through it and start dealing with the shame of, I used to think this way, and then the outcome of it is not loving, and I want to be loving, so I'm not going to think that way anymore. But you have to go through it. You can't, it's kind of like the can't go over it, can't go around it, can't go under it. Like, you got to go through it, you know it. And you absolutely have to find other people too, as well. I mean, there's the whole support network of it, but sharing your story and speaking that story out, finding someone that you can own it so that you can work through it. Cause otherwise you're not, you're going to dance around it. and you might not be able to really heal from it. So it's not fun. I mean, I know it's not, I'm not explaining a fun process. I'm explaining a very scary process, but there's so many people that I do think that have been through that process before. And that's why I want to share my story, because I've been through that process. I'd hate to think, you know, what I possibly could have been like right now. You know, like I absolutely, you know, I'm showing a little bit more about my ideas about January 6th, but I could absolutely have been there, you know, and been destructive based on what my beliefs were, you know, when we know about the NAR's connections to January 6th and things like that. So owning it and then sharing that word with others, I think that's, we have to break that shame. I think there's probably a lot of shame that exists in how we used to think about things.
I love it so much when I get somebody on who logically thinks and always thinks all the way down to the final conclusion. You've brought up a point that I don't know that many people have brought up yet. So we have all of these people being trained in this way of thinking, but nobody has really asked the question, what happens whenever the minister stands up and says, okay, now it's time, let's go. I don't hear that question being asked very much, but this has been going on for, gosh, it'll soon be 100 years if you go back and piece all this together. So 100 years of people who've been trained in that mindset, and at any given time, somebody stands up and says, this is it, bring out your weapons, let's go. That's a huge problem, right? And it's not Christianity. They're calling it Christianity, but what they've done is they've created a paramilitary organization under Christianity, and it's horrific. But thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.